This is The Guardian.
Today, why everything you've heard about panic buying might be wrong.
Queuing for petrol. Queuing for petrol.
Over the last 2 weeks, drivers across Britain have been struggling to get fuel, which has led some to seek out alternative forms of transport.
I don't need petrol, because I'm on a horse.
With fuel in short supply and queues to fill up appearing across large parts of the country, one word has come up again and again. Panic.
Panic buying has set in. The famous British stiff upper lip is quivering. Tempers are flaring. A warning not to panic buy seems to have fallen on deaf ears in the UK, as up to 90% of fuel stations ran dry across major English cities on Monday.
Some ministers have blamed the behaviour of people who are worried about running dry for causing a crisis at the pumps.
The only reason we don't have petrol on forecourts is that people are buying petrol and they don't need it.
But not everyone agrees with that. To Clifford Stott, a professor of social psychology at Keele University, who's advised the government on how to handle lockdowns, there's something completely different going on.
This deployment of the idea of the irrational crowd serves a very, very useful function for those in power, because it's leading everybody not to blame them, but to blame each other.
What he has to say about why we talk about panic buying and what he thinks is happening in reality might surprise you. And if he's right, it has huge implications for the way we see all kinds of crises in the modern world. From The Guardian, I'm Rachel Humphreys. Today in Focus, the real reason for the fuel crisis and why it's not your fault. Clifford, before we talk about the psychology of panic buying, you're an expert in crowd behaviour. Why? What is it about crowds that interest you?
Being in crowd events is really meaningful, and I'm interested in the kind of psychology that drives us in those kinds of situations. And also, if you think about how important crowds are to the way in which we live our lives, you know, revolutions, protests, collective action is central to everything we do. And that's what really interests me about psychology. I'm a social psychologist. I'm trying to understand how and why society shapes the way that we think, but also the way we think shapes the society that we live in.
Okay, and the reason we're speaking to you is because of a collective response over the past few weeks in the UK, a crowd mentality being called panic buying, which has been widely blamed for the recent fuel crisis. What do you take that phrase, panic buying, to mean?
Well, I think the first thing that I have to do is to challenge your terminology. I would actually argue we've been experiencing shortages. Where we deploy this idea of panic buying, we're also, in a sense, attributing cause. And I think we need to question that entire framework. Those shortages are caused by multiple and complex factors, and panic is certainly not one of them.
Okay, well, let's start with that word, panic. What does that mean to you?
Well, it's a really good question. And for me, panic implies the idea that our conscious psychology, our thinking, planned behavior, is overridden by an emotional reaction based on fear. So I panic. Oh my God, there's a fire. I've got to get, That's panic. Whereas rational, considered behavior is planned. It's based on cognition. It's thought through. So if we define panic in the way that I define it and define rationality in the way that I defined it, rational consideration is by far a better way of understanding what people are doing than panic. So it raises the question, why do we call it panic?
That's what I'm fascinated in. And also thank you for your representation of panic there, because that was great. I thought something was actually happening at your end. Right. So what do you think is driving people to get fuel if it's not panic?
They are rational considerations that are linked first and foremost to our absolute dependency on fuel.
I had just under 3/4, yeah, but I still thought, well, I don't know how long this is going to take to resolve. So it could be more than a week, and I was frightened to run out of petrol. I've got a job to do, I've got my mother to look after, shopping. You know, people are frightened, and people have got livelihoods who depend on driving.
People know that they need that fuel in order to get to work or to do the things that they have to do. And they also are aware of media stories that are saying to us that there are going to be fuel shortages.
BP petrol stations closing today as the company struggle to get enough fuel to its forecourts because of a lack of truck drivers.
And because of that, we start to think, well, if there are going to be shortages and I need that fuel, I'm going to have to go out and get it. That's not irrational. That's not panic. That's considered calculation of supply and demand and need and so on.
Even if this is a rational response, that's not how a lot of people see it.
We would not have closed pumps if people had not behaved with idiotic selfishness when they already had 90% full tanks. It's not about turning away people that need fuel to work. It's about not going to the station when you don't need to.
And I wondered if you felt there was a moralising element to all of this. You know, I've been quite struck by, in the last week, social media users who are angry at other people for buying petrol, and you see pictures of, you know, one man filling up like 8 cans on a forecourt, but then they say their own purchase is essential. I mean, do we tend to frame our own choices about this stuff in a more positive light than we do about other people?
I mean, isn't it interesting that we're blaming each other for the problem rather than the government?
Yes.
That's one of the things that's going on here. And I mean, the point that you deploy there about the jerry cans, I heard a really interesting interview with a care worker who was desperate to get fuel and wasn't able to go to work with all of the consequences because she couldn't access fuel. But in the end, she managed to access £15 worth of fuel. But do you know how she had to access it? In a jerry can, because she couldn't get a car to the petrol station. So I think this sort of moralisation bit is really, really quite problematic.
So you're saying people are responding rationally, whether it's to a shortage of fuel or, as happened at the start of the pandemic, a shortage of toilet roll, which actually seems to be a bit of a recurring issue. I was reading about the toilet paper panic in America in 1973.
Amidst the recent preoccupation with the fuel shortage and the meat shortage, a new gap has appeared in the staples of the American household, the toilet paper shortage.
They buy it before we put it on the shelf.
I'm used to being able to go when I want to, but suddenly I think I'm going to have to start curbing my habit.
What is your explanation for why all these things happen if it's not because we're panic buying?
When we think about the toilet paper shortages or the pasta shortages at the beginning of the pandemic,
items like toilet roll, hand sanitizer and pasta are now increasingly hard to come by as coronavirus-linked panic buying continues.
I've done tins and toilet roll, and I've done pasta, non-perishables, and I have filled a freezer.
What we're experiencing are changes in behavioural patterns. And those behavioural patterns are basically about rapid upsurge in the levels of demand at unexpected times. So the supply chain hasn't had the opportunity to gear itself up for that upsurge in demand. Let's consider an example. We don't run out of Brussels sprouts at Christmas.
That's because nobody likes them.
Well, I like them. Lots of people like them. They're in the supermarkets. They're there, aren't they? And in
yes,
a sense,
they are.
The shelves aren't empty at Christmas because the supermarkets are ready for that massive upsurge in demand. So many people at Christmas end up with food that they don't eat. You know, the levels of demand are excessive, but we don't run out because the supply chains are prepared for them. And that's what's gone wrong here. And what it speaks to us about is the fragility of supply chains. Since the pandemic hit us, what we've ended up with is a disrupted supply chain. And that has been amplified by Brexit. amplified by poor preparations in terms of investment in the industry, investment in the working conditions for truck drivers.
One estimate says 90,000 lorry drivers are needed. The UK's Road Haulage Association asked its members why. 58% said Brexit.
And it's come to a head.
It's interesting, isn't it, when you set it out like that, that we like, or we do believe the narrative that something, a crisis, a shortage is being caused by seemingly, you know, stupid people going and buying tons of toilet roll, when there's actually a much more logical explanation. But we kind of maybe like to believe more in the frailty of other people rather than actually a wider, bigger structural societal issue.
Yeah, well, it's one of the biggest challenges that I have as a crowd psychologist, unpacking and deconstructing how we tend to think about collective psychology, because it's so deeply rooted into popular consciousness. And it's really difficult for people to accept that you can see things in a different way, because you've got to kind of reject the popular representations that are all around us. And what's really surprised me in this particular crisis is how much further we've gone in reinforcing the idea of panic. Mass panic is a narrative. It's just everywhere, despite the fact that it's wrong.
These then are very dominant ideas, Clifford. But where do they come from? Where do these ideas about mass panic originate?
They originate predominantly in the 19th century. Prior to industrialisation, we had an agrarian economy and an aristocracy that were the real brokers of power. But with the birth of cities comes the birth of mass society. And the social sciences really evolve to try to build theories and understandings of what was happening to human society in the context of the Industrial Revolution. And one of the key questions revolved around mass psychology. And the conclusion that the elite academic community came to was that the mass were people who didn't have good intellectual capacity, who didn't have the civilized consideration of those who had risen to the top of society, who were fundamentally better, cleverer, more rational people. And that idea lies at the heart of mass panic, because it is conveying the idea that the first thing the masses do when faced with a challenge is collapse into their inherent irrationality. And riding to the rescue are the rational elites who will come in and restore order.
That is absolutely fascinating, Clifford. And so much of that tone and that language and that approach still feels very present in our society today.
Well, obviously, those people have a tendency to be anxious at these times. Many of them will have filled their cars up. And so there does come a point, as we saw with a previous episode of panic buying during the pandemic on food, there does come a time when things settle down, people get used to it and return to life as normal again.
But the point you seem to be making is that the way we think crowds are reacting is basically founded in a sort of 200-year-old intellectual snobbery.
Yeah, that's a very good way to put it. And I think the problem with this is not just that it's mythical, it's dangerous. If you look at the work that we do in the era of public disorder and rioting, a key element of that work has been focused on getting police training to stop using these outdated theories of the crowd, because these outdated theories of the crowd were leading police commanders to make decisions that actually caused violence.
And we know this is something that police have thought about a lot more in recent years, and they've developed new ways for policing protests, for example. But an event I'm thinking of, which I think is most relevant to what you're talking about, is the Hillsborough disaster in 1989, where the police's assumptions about how the crowd at an FA Cup semi-final would behave meant they took decisions which led to the deaths of 97 Liverpool fans. And as we've talked about on the podcast before, shaped the subsequent cover-up.
But at the time, even as people were dying in the central pens of the terrace, Duckingfield lied and said that Liverpool supporters had gained unauthorised entry via an exit gate In fact, he had ordered it to be opened. The police had to correct that lie, but it nevertheless started a story which the South Yorkshire Police told to the media and official legal procedures which followed, that the people who had suffered themselves were drunken hooligans who were to blame for the disaster.
But can you give me examples of events where the panic of the crowd did put people in danger?
That's the thing, you see. It's where you look at this empirically, you don't find that. There's been lots and lots of research into how people behave in mass emergencies. And what you tend to find is that people don't panic. Now, it is the case, of course, that people in situations where their lives are under threat find themselves being overwhelmed by fear. I mean, of course you do. People do, for want of a better description, freak out. But what you tend to find is that that's individuals who are freaking out. The vast majority of people in that circumstance don't. And a really powerful example of this is some research done by John Drury and others at the University of Sussex into how people behaved in the immediate wake of the July 7th bombings on the London Underground.
At Aldgate East, where the injured were treated on the pavement outside the station. At King's Cross, where hundreds were moved to safety, having escaped the horrors below ground. And at Russell Square, what was left of the number 30 bus.
And in that circumstance, when that bomb went off on the train and it was stuck in the tunnel, people didn't panic, people didn't run, and it was well over half an hour before the emergency services got down to those trains. And what they found were groups of people who were on that train who had helped each other. In fact, several people survived because others around them, complete strangers, stayed. And in so many different studies that we've looked at, that's what happens.
So what you're saying then, Clifford, by the sounds of things, is that we need a new term other than panic buying. It's not helpful.
It's extremely unhelpful, and absolutely we need a new term. And this lazy, casual deployment of panic buying is part of the problem. And we can understand why at some level, because you know, we've got a situation where we seem to assume that the job of journalists is always to tell the truth, where it's not. It's to sell newspapers. Bad news is good news from a news-telling point of view.
The Eye writing about tonight's developments that the army could be called up to help tackle the fuel crisis. The Financial Times also running with the fuel crisis story. They say that the health service could be at risk because of a lack of fuel.
Instead of focusing immediately on where you can find queues, wouldn't it be great if all of the media outlets, when the crisis began to emerge, were focused on finding petrol stations and fuel stations that had fuel?
Obviously, as a journalist, I would say this, but I think most journalists would report if they saw a fight happening on a forecourt because of fuel shortages. But I take your point, there's some balance to be made there in terms of how the media communicate what's going on. And language is obviously very important, which is something that the government have taken on board because this amount of buying has then caused a problem in itself. And last week it was revealed that the Cabinet Office wants councils to stop using terms like panic buying or stockpiling and instead say things like filling up earlier than usual. The Transport Secretary, Grant Shapps, described the situation as manufactured and said there wouldn't be queues or shortages if people acted sensibly. Is all of this the right way to approach this situation?
Well, there's elements of progress there for sure in terms of how you're describing what the Cabinet Office are advising should be the language and the narratives. But I think throughout the pandemic and in this particular crisis, we've suffered from extremely poor messaging from government. I mean, for example, in relationship to the fuel crisis, telling people to only get what they need. Well, I need my fuel, I need a full tank, and I need it now. So how does telling me that I should only buy what I need change anything? It doesn't. But it also speaks to us about something I think is also really fundamentally going wrong, that people are losing trust in government messaging altogether, that in a sense it didn't really matter by that point what the government said because people weren't going to listen to it.
Coming up, what Clifford didn't see coming in the way we responded to the pandemic. Clifford, what you're arguing, that in reality we don't panic in a crisis, is quite hard to get your head around, actually. I'm certainly finding myself having to think differently about the way I've seen people's behaviour over the past few weeks. And this is because these assumptions are deeply embedded. And we saw that in the way the government approached announcing a national lockdown at the start of the pandemic last year. The Prime Minister's former adviser, Dominic Cummings, has said that they delayed doing so because they didn't think people would accept it.
Secondly, it's inconceivable that the British public are going to accept Wuhan-style measures here.
Do you think that was a reasonable assumption?
Well, it's been a big area of debate. I was myself involved in the advisory group SPY-B from as early as late February. So a lot of the advice we were developing there was feeding into government during their decision making. And what was really interesting from my point of view is that it wasn't just government that was fearful about what would be needed to be done to control this pandemic. I think it's fair to say that we were too. When we were confronted in late February with the realization that what would be required would be the wholesale closure of all of society, that was something that was completely unprecedented. And then to sit there and think, well, how are people going to behave here? What are people likely to do if this happens? And I think it's fair to say that we were all surprised by what people actually did, which was to heavily comply and not to resist. I think we'd all expected that there would be significant areas in which people just simply would not accept this kind of thing. But they did. People's responses were about solidarity. They were about coming together. They were about exercising social responsibility in the face of very, very significant and severe changes to the way that we were required to live our lives. I think now we all feel that they're quite normal. In fact, it's abnormal to go back to work. But here we are. And I think that, yes, the government was reticent about closing down. But I also have argued previously, it wasn't the government that closed us down. We started to mobilize as a society, recognizing the threat that we were faced with. Pressure was placed on the football authorities to close. Football closed down. Then pressure was placed on the universities. Universities closed down. And then once that had happened, it was almost inevitable that schools were going to close down. And it was only at that point that the government itself actually locked down. So it wasn't really government decision making that took us into lockdown. It was us.
What should we take from this for the future? You know, now we know that as a society, we can respond very collectively. Could the government use this to perhaps prevent future shortages or maybe even change our everyday behaviours in the context of the climate crisis?
Well, I certainly think that that's a powerful consideration we now need to get to work on, because unfortunately, the pandemic is just the start of things to come. The level of social change that we're going to have to go through over the next 20 odd years to reduce our carbon footprint is more profound than the 100 years of the Industrial Revolution. And there will be resistance to that social change. There will be protest. There will be conflict. And our ability to manage that conflict in ways that allow us to retain the idea that we're a democracy are really, really important. First and foremost, these ideas of irrationality inherent in the public as the public as a problem is wrong, because what we see is the public are a key part of the solution. The public are resilient, and that we need a situation where the public are empowered to be resilient by building from the bottom up. But let's not fall into the trap of over-psychologizing these, because it's not just a psychological issue. We're talking about complex global-wide supply chains. You know, supply chains are weak because they don't hold stock in storage, because if you do that, it costs you money. So it's all about just in time. So we need to move away from just in time globalized economies. We need to focus on localized economies. And that's nothing to do with psychology and everything to do with a broader problem of how human society is going to cope with a climate crisis that is already over the horizon and beginning to rain down upon us.
Clifford, it's been fascinating to speak to you. Thank you very much.
Thanks. Pleasure to have the opportunity.
That was Clifford Stott. To keep up with the latest on the fuel shortages and how the government is tackling the supply chain crisis, follow the Politics Live blog at theguardian.com, where today you'll also find coverage of the Prime Minister's speech to Conservative Party conference. That's it for today. This episode was produced by Courtney Youssef and Alex Atack. Sound design was by Axel Cacoutier. The executive producers are Archie Bland and Phil Maynard. We'll be back tomorrow.
This is The Guardian.